Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. This holiday season, we are taking a look back at some of our favorite interviews from throughout the year. First up, Matthew Desmond, author of the New York Times bestseller Evicted, which shone a light on how eviction is not just a condition of poverty, but a cause of it. Next up, Sarah McBride, a former CAP staffer whom we miss desperately, who's now at the Human Rights Campaign, and the first ever transgender speaker at a major party convention. Finally, Daryl Atkinson, the inaugural Second Chance Fellow at the Department of Justice, speaking about reentry policy and the importance of including people with criminal records in that conversation. Let's take a listen.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross.
And I'm Rebecca Vallis. We are so pleased to have you with us, Matthew Desmond, author of Evicted. I know Tracy and I have both been nerding out over your book, so congratulations on the release of something that's going to be really, really important in shining a light on eviction, not just as a condition of poverty, but really also as a cause of it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for having me.
And so before we, dive into some of the content of your book, can you just explain a little bit about what led you to Milwaukee and to cover evictions?
I'd always been really troubled by the amount of poverty in this country, the fact that America is really unmatched by any wealthy democracy for the depth and expanse of its poverty. And I wanted to figure that out, and I wanted to see how housing was playing a role in driving poverty in our cities. I chose Milwaukee because I wanted to write a book that had a shot at representing a broader American experience. A lot of the books on poverty are being written on the margins, either focusing on some of the cities that we consider our biggest successes, like New York or San Francisco, or some of the cities that some people say are our biggest failures, like Camden or Detroit. I think Milwaukee gives us a opportunity to write about experiences that are like those in Kansas City and Indianapolis and Cleveland. So it is a book that's really set in Milwaukee, but it tells a larger national story.
And in order to sort of take a very close and personal look at the issue of eviction, how it impacts individuals, families, communities, you actually embedded yourself within the communities, the low-income communities, who experience eviction at such alarming rates. Tell us a little bit about the way in which you sort of committed ethnography for this book.
Right. So I decided if I wanted to understand the role that eviction was playing in people's lives and also why landlords evict people and how they go about their business, which is a really important part of the book, I decided that I needed to see it up close and personal. So I moved into a trailer park on the far south side of Milwaukee, and I rented a trailer and I lived there for several months. And then I moved into a rooming house on the north side of the city, which is the traditional inner city, the predominantly African-American part of the city. And I lived there for about 10 months. And from those two neighborhoods, I met several families going through eviction. And I went to eviction court with them. I watched their kids, slept at their houses. If they left Milwaukee, I left with them. I followed them into trailer parks and into abandoned houses and shelters. And generally tried to get as close to their everyday lives as I could. I went to things like funerals and counseling sessions and even a birth. But I also knew that if I really wanted to understand the connection between housing and poverty, I needed to understand the landlord's perspective. So if you were getting evicted, I wanted to get just as close as your landlord doing the evicting. So I did. And so the book also covers landlords, and I watch them buy properties, sell properties, evict you but not me. I kind of understood what makes them tick, how much money they make, and tried to kind of write about this this problem from that point of view as well.
And digging a little bit into the landlords, because that was part of what was especially fascinating to me in reading this book, you start with, you actually open the book with Sherina Tarver.
Right.
Many of the names have been changed and you use pseudonyms, but she's a former teacher turned, as you call her, an inner city entrepreneur who really has made quite a living renting to poor black residents in Milwaukee. But that chapter really has the effect of humanizing her. her. Simultaneously, we're getting introduced to her tenants, some of whom she's actually in the process of evicting, but we really see her as much of a human character, and in some ways even sympathetic, almost as much so as we do some of the individuals that are her tenants. Why start the book off that way from the perspective of a landlord?
I feel that, you know, poverty isn't just about people that don't have a lot of money or about neighborhoods that are characterized by high poverty rates. It's relationship. It involves rich people and non-rich people alike. It involves landlords and tenants alike. And I think that I wanted to try to write a book that was broader, in a sense, and included the stories and perspectives of people that were not poor, but were very important to the lives of low-income families. I mean, landlords literally own poor neighborhoods. You know, they dictate where people live, why they have to move, who they get to live with. And so I think that starting with the landlords was my way of saying, look, if we really want to understand poverty, we have to expand our vision beyond just poor people and poor communities. I think that, you know, your response to how I wrote about Sharina, I feel like that means that I did my job, because it is complicated. It's complicated, and we let ourselves off the hook. We don't get to have the really hard conversation if we just say, oh, these tenants, they're irresponsible, or these landlords, they're just greedy. When you really embed yourself with both parties, you find that the story is much more messier than that.
You discuss and you really show through the people's lives whom you profile in this book how eviction of one family can actually destabilize, as you put it, multiple city blocks. Not only the block from which a family was evicted, but also the block to which it's begrudgingly relocated. You highlight a family that includes Doreen and Patrice, and they get evicted from a house where they're doing okay and they have enough space among eight people, but they end up having to relocate to one of Shireen's properties with eight people effectively living in a two-bedroom apartment. Talk a little bit about how eviction can have effects on not just families, but whole neighborhoods and communities.
Right. So in some of the poorest neighborhoods in Milwaukee, the eviction rate is astoundingly high. And so we know from the work of sociologists like Rob Sampson that, you know, to really, when people really invest in their communities and work together to make it better, they can make a real difference. You know, they can drive down crime. They can call for political action in their community. But that becomes impossible if people can't hang on to those communities, if those communities aren't sticky because so many people are moving in and out of them. And so we have some data from Milwaukee that shows that neighborhoods with higher eviction rates have higher violent crime rates the following year. And I think that eviction plays a big role in that. Now, when people move out of one neighborhood into the other, we know that they often move into a worse neighborhood. They're moving from a poorer neighborhood to an even poorer one. And they often relocate to substandard housing, like Doreen and Patrice and the whole Hingston family did. And so under those conditions, people don't want to invest in a new neighborhood. They don't kind of say, gosh, we're here now and let's make it better. They want to get out. They want to get out. And so eviction often in that way leads to not one move, but two. And it can destabilize families and communities several moves removed from the actual eviction. And that's just one of many consequences that follows forced displacement.
And you highlight the ripple effects of evictions in the realm of mental health as well. And you talk about the number of suicides that are attributed to evictions and foreclosures, that they in fact doubled between 2005 and 2010. You know, this is different than your typical book or reporter or study on housing in that it gets into the mental aspects of it. Can you, I guess, explain what the reactions to that aspect of your work has been like?
You know, it's a sad but very true finding, an aspect of eviction, that it doesn't just have an effect on your residential instability, your material hardship, the neighborhood you live in, the kind of housing you live in does affect all those things, but it also affects your spirit, you know, your mental health. We have a study that shows that moms that were evicted have higher rates of depression 2 years later after the eviction. that has to have a enormous effect on family life, the relationship with their children, their energy level, their ability to kind of go find work. And every sheriff that I've met that is part of the eviction squad has suicide stories. You know, the story of knocking on the door and hearing a gunshot, you know, afterwards. That should disturb us. That should concern us deeply. It seems that eviction is not just affecting the home. It affects so much more than that.
And just to follow up, you know, you open in the book up talking about how communities used to really rally against evictions, that you would have protests, you know, maybe up to 1,000 people or more protesting, making sure that a household didn't get evicted. What do you think shifted in our culture that we went from seeing eviction as a horrible fate to something that's in the shadows?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, when you read books from the 1930s, 1940s, you know, evictions were rare and they were scandalous. You know, they drew crowds. And it hasn't always been the case that poor families in this country couldn't pay rent. You know, this is something that's got a lot worse over the last decade, and evictions have become commonplace. You know, we have sheriff squad whose full-time job is to carry out eviction all day. We have moving companies who work from sunup to sundown, you know, pushing families out. We have literally hundreds of data mining companies that record evictions and sell that information to landlords. And so we've had a surge of eviction in recent years, and I think that maps on to the fact that incomes for low-income families have been stagnant or fallen, but housing costs have soared, not only rent, but also utilities. And public policy has failed to bridge the gap. I think most Americans that don't live in trailer parks or in the inner city still think that the typical low-income family benefits some way from public housing or housing assistance. But as you guys know, the opposite is true. Only about 1 in 4 families that qualify for housing assistance receive it, which is kind of unthinkable with other basic necessities like food. What if we turned away 3 in 4 families that applied for food stamps? But that's exactly how we treat housing aid today. And under those conditions, eviction has become frankly, commonplace in our poorest neighborhoods.
And of course, as your book really profiles in a lot of detail, it isn't just eviction; it's also the substandard conditions, rather, that low-income renters are really forced to accept. A theme that really runs throughout your book, and perhaps could even maybe be a substitute title for your book, is exploitation.
So I feel that there's two questions in there. One is about the conditions people are living in. There's some good news here, and the good news is, you know, we have taken major strides in the right direction when it comes to improving low-income families' housing conditions. Just a few generations ago, slums were ravaging our cities. You know, people were living without heat and running water and ventilation. You know, babies were getting tuberculosis. There were outhouses in the middle of Philadelphia. We as a nation took on a battle with slums, and we won. And this book, and I certainly will not shy away from the fact that we still have a lot to go there. You know, when I lived in the trailer park, most of the time I didn't have hot water, even though I told the landlord, I'm a writer, I'm going to write about you and your trailer park. So just imagine what my neighbors had to endure. So we do have a long way to go here, but we've made impressive strides. So why? What's going on? Don't we have laws that protect families, you know, from living in substandard conditions? And my response to that is yes, but those laws do not reach the very bottom. Because if you are someone like Arlene, who is paying 88% of your income to rent, you're going to have to ask your landlord's compassion one day. Often you move in and you're behind because you can't pay your first and last month's rent and a security deposit. You can barely pay first month's rent. And so under those conditions, tenants really execute their rights with great risk of eviction. Landlords are forbidden to retaliate against the tenant who reports housing problems. They can at any time evict a tenant who's behind. So it's not that tenants don't know their rights. It's not that those rights don't exist. It's that they literally cost money, and tenants know that exercising those rights when they're severely rent-burdened, when they're behind, when they have to ask landlords for favors, and under those conditions, those rights really become toothless. So, and then there's a second question about exploitation and and how we think about that. And the way I came to think about that is, you know, poverty isn't just a product of low incomes. It's also a product of exploitation, you know. And we have to face the reality that there's some people that make a lot of money off poor people and poor communities. When I started this book, I wondered, you know, why would anyone, you know, rent a trailer park and own a trailer park? You know, what? Why would you do that? Why would you buy property in the inner city and manage it? And then when I finished the book, I kind of was like, well, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? The profits are there. The profits are there if you have a stomach for that kind of work. So the landlord in the trailer park that I lived in, which at that time was considered an environmental biohazard by the city, owned 131 trailers. And I looked at his rent rolls, calculated his income by looking at his actual books, you know, so I could pay attention to things like vacancies and missed payments. There are a lot of missed payments. His mortgage records, tax records, water bill, all this kind of stuff. And I tried to get the most rigorous estimate possible, which was this landlord was taking home about $470,000 a year after expenses. That's literally a lifetime difference between him and his tenants. That's 30 times what his tenants working full-time for minimum wage were making, and it's about 50 times what his tenants receiving disability were taking in. So I think we have to confront that fact and ask, can we make a big difference when it comes to poverty in America if we don't confront the fact that that there is a business model at the bottom of every market.
And another tension that took place in the book was the fact that I think you yourself, it seemed reluctant to have to talk about the, I guess, bad things or bad choices that the people that you profiled made. I think there was one article about your book talking about how you were frustrated that one of the people spent their food stamps on a lobster dinner. And so I would be interested in you explaining a bit about how you hope people read your book, because I get the sense that you wanted to share the real stories, but often there's this urge or this instinct people have to evaluate the behavior of the poor and that they somehow must be more moral than the rest of the country. You know, could you explain that tension a bit?
So the moment that you're talking about involved Lorraine. And Lorraine was my neighbor in the trailer park. She was a grandmother. And at the time we met, you know, she was paying over 70% of her income on rent. She received disability for a childhood accident that left her impaired. And this was a moment where she wanted to celebrate an anniversary with her deceased boyfriend, who mattered very much in her life. And she did. She took her entire allotment of food stamps and blew it on a single meal, and consisting of lobster and king crab. And you know, when I learned about that, and I want to stress that this is one instance in the book. You know, this is not something Lorraine did over and over again. And it's also not something she did because she had too many food stamps. You know, she took it on the chin after she did that. She went hungry some nights, and she had to kind of scour food pantries and other places to receive enough food to make it to the end of the month. But she didn't apologize for that. You know, she didn't apologize. She wanted to do something special and for that evening and that night. And I took it that was my job to really understand that, to not apologize on her behalf, and to really look that thing in the face and provide a logic for it. And the logic that I came to was, you know, Lorraine is not poor because she's making bad decisions. She's making bad decisions because she's poor, in a way. You know, there's no amount of skimping and saving that are going to pull Lorraine above the poverty line. She's living so far beneath it and giving so much of her income on housing. And under those conditions, you might as well pepper the suffering with color. You know, you might as well live fully. And that's what Lorraine did. And I thought it was my job to write about these things with as much complexity and honesty as I could. I thought ignoring those does no one a service.
in the final minute for which we have you, I would feel remiss if we didn't ask, given the nature of this sort of ethnographic work, if you could talk a little bit about how you see your role in this work. You're you know, very close to people who are almost constantly facing crisis, where in the example of Lorraine, there's a moment where she's desperately trying to come up with $150 to prevent an eviction. How did you handle situations like that where you knew you could have intervened and changed the course of these people's lives and prevented crisis, but perhaps at the expense of what others consuming your work might have viewed as the integrity of the ethnography?
I don't know if I could have changed the course of their life. You know, Lorraine paid 70% of her income every month. So if I stepped in 1 month, the first of the month for the next is coming. And I think that I always thought of myself as riding in a tradition that's deeply connected to reform. And that tradition is bearing witness to suffering. That tradition is about trying to understand people's lives from shoulder height, you know, and write about those things. My relationship with the folks in the book became organic. You know, I bought them food, they bought me food, I bought them gifts, they bought me gifts. There are some points in the book where I did intervene in a major way, and those are articulated at the end, just so readers know what happened and why I did it. But I thought that there we could make a bigger difference if I tried to intervene as little as possible and instead wrote about these things in a larger way. And that's what I did. I think that I think we see this in books, especially with housing, going back to Jacob Riis, where if you can, you know, write about people's lives and show the broader American public what's really going on out there, that has a real shot at changing the public conversation and hopefully changing public policy.
We've been speaking with Matthew Desmond. He's a Harvard sociologist whose book Evicted was just released and shines a light on the reality of eviction in Milwaukee, but really across the country. He also has a website that he's started called justshelter.org. People can go there and be connected with resources either in their state or at the national level if they'd like to learn more about how they can get involved. Matthew Desmond, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. With me in studio to discuss an incredibly historic, really, I think is probably the right word, week for equality and specifically for transgender individuals is Sarah McBride. She is a total rock star here at the Center for American Progress and leads our work on these issues. Sarah, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me on the best trans week ever.
Best trans week ever. So why has this been the best trans week ever? Walk us through some of the big announcements and news.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's safe to say that transgender Americans have seen more progress in the last 5 days than potentially at any point in our community and movement's history. Starting on Monday, a lawsuit was filed by the U.S. Department of Justice against the state of North Carolina over their discriminatory and mean-spirited bill HB2, which, among other things, requires or bans transgender people from accessing restrooms consistent with their gender identity. And in announcing that lawsuit, the Attorney General delivered probably the most profound and moving and frankly forceful speech in favor of transgender rights that we've ever seen from a senior administration official.
She went so far as to actually compare HB2 to Jim Crow laws. How did she make that comparison? Do you think that it's apt?
She did. And her way of making the comparison was talking about it was, throughout our history, we have too often sided with exclusion and discrimination. Too often in our history, we have had distinctions without a difference, and that has included signs among restrooms that separated Black Americans from white Americans. Now, obviously, no two movements and no two communities are the same. And as a white transgender person, I'm cautious in making that comparison myself. But I think her point was that saying that transgender women can't use women's restrooms and saying transgender men can't use men's restrooms, and the rationale behind that is a distinction without a difference, in the same way that requiring people of different races to use different bathrooms.
And for that reason, some people in the trans community and more broadly in the progressive community are actually calling her speech the trans movement's I Have a Dream moment. Is that how it feels right now?
Well, I certainly think it's going to take a trans person to deliver our movement's I Have a Dream speech, but there's no question that that speech was not just pivotal from a sort of broader historical perspective, but also incredibly helpful and empowering for the community itself, particularly after weeks of both rhetorical and legislative attacks that we've seen in states like North Carolina, in states like South Dakota or Tennessee that tried to pass similar bills. It was truly a turning point, and it was only the start of the week. Yesterday, news broke that the U.S. Department of Education and the U.S. Department of Justice would be issuing clear and comprehensive guidance requiring schools to allow transgender students access to facilities and programs consistent with their gender identity, and requiring schools to treat those students consistent with their gender identity. And then today, the Department of Health and Human Services released a final rule that interpreted the sex protections in the Affordable Care Act to ban discrimination based on gender identity and gender stereotypes, which provide incredible protections, particularly for the transgender community, who no longer can face categorical exclusions for medical care around their transition in healthcare programs funded by the federal government.
So help us unpack that a little bit. We're speaking, it's Friday of this week, so folks who are listening over the weekend and in future days to come know that this all has played out throughout the course of this week. But unpack for us a little bit what you just said and what the importance is of rejecting that kind of categorical exclusion.
One of the most frequent forms of discrimination that transgender people face are these blanket exclusions that exist in insurance plans that say, despite the fact that the medical community has deemed transition-related care, that's surgeries or hormone therapy or any kind of treatment related to transitioning genders, despite the fact that the medical community has deemed those treatments medically necessary, insurance plans have historically, at least in the last several decades, said we will not cover any care related to that. Despite the fact that most of those procedures, almost all of those procedures, are actually provided for other people for other reasons. And so it's a pretty clear-cut instance of we're going to provide this service for everyone but transgender people, despite the fact that transgender people, based on science, based on medicine, based on the needs of these transgender people, need these services just as much as other people.
So I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention, for our listeners' benefit, that this is a set of issues that is incredibly personal for you. This is not just an advocacy issue that you lead on here at the Center for American Progress, but actually some of our listeners may be familiar with you, the celebrity that you are. You took a selfie that went viral in a North Carolina bathroom. It ended up on MSNBC and basically every other news outlet that was worth its salt. I may be biased, but that is my view. What was the significance of the selfie you took in North Carolina, and what is the significance of the issues we're talking about to you?
Well, I, as you mentioned, I took a selfie while using a restroom in North Carolina in a government building that I was technically barred from being in. And I took the selfie and posted it on Instagram and Facebook, and it blew up far more than I ever could have expected. I took it not because I wanted to demonstrate, oh, look at me and don't I belong in this space. I took it to try to bring some humanity to this issue, move past the rhetoric, move past the abstract arguments and the unfounded fears, and say we are real people and we need access to bathrooms. If we can't access bathrooms consistent with who we are, it becomes much harder to go to work. It becomes much harder to go to school. It becomes much harder to participate in public life. Banning people from restrooms that make sense for them effectively removes people from every aspect of society. And so I took the picture and posted a message along with it in an attempt to say this isn't about what we look like. This is about who we are. This isn't about our appearance. It's about our humanity. But this entire issue for me and where I come to this work for me is so much more than my own identity as a transgender person. And not to get super deep, but I come to this work not just as someone who is transgender, but also as someone who's loved someone who's transgender. I met my future husband, Andy, fighting for trans equality. We ended up working together here at the Center for American Progress, and we fell in love. Shortly after we started dating, he was diagnosed with cancer. Andy was a transgender man who had come out in college. He had the courage to say to this world that says who we are is wrong that he wouldn't spend one more day hiding. And after he received a clean bill of health, his cancer came back and it was terminal. Andy and I decided to get married in August of 2014, and just 4 days after that, he passed away. There are a lot of things that I took from that relationship with Andy and that experience with Andy, but for me, more than anything else, and this goes to creating safe schools, this goes to removing exclusions that allow transgender people the treatment they need to live true to themselves. The lesson that I took was that every day matters when it comes to building a world where every person can live their life to the fullest. And the last several days, we've seen the Obama administration stand up and come out on the right side. They've always been on the right side, but forcefully come out on the right side of history on this, and to bring equality to millions of Americans that have been excluded for generations.
Thank you for sharing what I know is a personal and difficult to share story, but I think it does provide a lot of, as you said, humanity to what we're talking about. I think from where I sit reading the news coverage, almost all of it focuses on bathrooms, right? These bills, which are not exclusive to North Carolina, which really have been spreading like wildfire across the country, and that's worth reminding ourselves about. It isn't just North Carolina. The coverage often focuses on bathrooms and often the declarations of why we need these, quote, protections for people, right? It focuses on protecting people in bathrooms. Why do you think that that's the thing that advocates of this kind of discrimination lead with?
Bathrooms have been a central component of anti-equality forces throughout the last 60 years. Every single movement for equality, from civil rights to the push for the Equal Rights Amendment to advocacy for the Americans with Disabilities Act, every single effort in part has centered around bathrooms. I think for many people, transgender people and non-transgender people alike, bathrooms are understandably vulnerable spaces. For whatever reasons, bathrooms are spaces where we feel exposed and potentially so vulnerable that we feel unsafe. But what opponents have done, particularly in this fight around access to restrooms consistent with folks' gender identity, is they have said that if you protect transgender people from discrimination in bathrooms, if you continue to allow transgender people to access the restrooms they've been accessing just now without fear of discrimination or harassment, that there will be predators who will take advantage of those laws to harm women and children. This is an argument that they made against gay Americans 30, 40 years ago. It was untrue then and it's untrue now. And we know that for a number of reasons. We know that because we've passed transgender protections, including in restrooms, we have them in 18 states, and we've passed them in over 200 cities. And we have never seen an instance where one of these laws has allowed for or facilitated violence or public safety incidences in public restrooms. Law enforcement in those states and communities have come out and said that these fears are unfounded. And 250 of the nation's leading sexual assault and domestic violence organizations have come out and said protecting transgender people in bathrooms, from protecting them from discrimination, doesn't hurt anyone, and banning them from restrooms doesn't help anyone. And if anything, it only perpetuates and increases violence against an already vulnerable community.
And that was part of what Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General, focused on in her speech. She really called out North Carolina Governor McCrory and the way that he's been messaging around that particular bill, HB2. She said, "You've been told that this law protects vulnerable populations from harm, but that is just not the case. Instead, what this law does is inflict further indignity on a population that has already suffered far more than its fair share. It provides no benefit to society. All it does is to harm innocent Americans."
And it's 100% true. The facts bear it out. The reality bears it out. And the transgender community that's under attack, we're making that clear. 70% of transgender people in one study have been harassed, assaulted, or discriminated against in a public restroom.
70%.
That's an astonishing number. The people who we know are vulnerable in bathrooms are marginalized communities, including the transgender community. Predators are not going to put on a dress to access a restroom in order to commit a crime simply because we protect transgender people from discrimination. The idea that non-discrimination laws are relevant to a person committing a crime that was illegal the day before these protections were passed and a crime that's illegal the day after these protections were passed, the idea that that comes into play is completely unfounded and, frankly, a ridiculous idea.
So stepping back just a little bit and you know, perhaps reflecting on why this is a relevant conversation for a show that is called Talk Poverty Radio, how does this bear on a fight for economic inclusion and for the economic potential that trans individuals have in this country?
We know that transgender people already face incredibly high rates, disproportionately high rates of unemployment. The poverty rate within the transgender community is astronomically high. And that's a result in part of the pervasive discrimination in employment, in housing, in public accommodations, in healthcare that transgender people face across the country. The reality is already very difficult for a lot of people within the trans community. And when states and localities come in and further restrict or foster and perpetuate that discrimination, it results in even more negative outcomes, economic outcomes, health outcomes. As I said, if you can't access a restroom that's consistent with your gender identity at work or at school or when you're going out shopping for goods and services we all need to live and thrive, it becomes much harder to do those things. And at best, it results in negative health outcomes at work that will inevitably lead to less productivity, less employee loyalty, and potentially unemployment. And at worst, it keeps the person from participating in those activities entirely, which, as we know, leads to negative health and economic outcomes.
So where do we expect this lawsuit that the Department of Justice has brought against HB2 to go? There's going to be activity in the coming week. What's ahead of us and what do we expect to come from it?
I think advocates are optimistic about this lawsuit for a number of reasons. One, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals just 3 or 4 weeks ago already ruled that Title IX, the federal statute that protects people based on sex in federally funded educational activities, protects transgender students. So the court that is hearing this lawsuit, the lawsuit both that McCrory filed in North Carolina and the lawsuit that Loretta Lynch in the Department of Justice filed, they've already ruled on aspects of this question. And it's highly likely that they will find the same thing as it relates to employment as they already have found as it relates to students. If that happens, there's a possibility that this case is then appealed to the Supreme Court. And it's unclear whether the Supreme Court will take it. If they don't take it, the Fourth Circuit's decision will stand. If they do take it and create firm nationwide precedent that transgender people are protected under existing sex protections, that will not only have a monumental impact and effect on transgender people nationwide, it'll provide clarity for states, localities, and employers. It will also, move our country forward in another step like the one we saw a year ago with the Supreme Court's marriage equality decision. The question, though, is how the court splits. If it splits 4-4 with the vacancy that it has right now, the appeals court decision will stand. Certainly we want a nationwide precedent, and it is vital that we fill that final vacancy on the Supreme Court, in part because we want to make sure that there is a nationwide standard for treatment of transgender people.
So you mentioned the landmark Supreme Court ruling that made marriage equality the law of the land last year. We at the top, you described this week as the best trans week ever. But do you feel that what we've heard from the Obama administration, from Attorney General Lynch, and more broadly, this kind of set of landmark announcements and steps in this amazing direction, does all of this have bearing not just for the trans community, but more broadly for LGBT folks generally, and perhaps even beyond that?
Well, I think there's a couple answers to that. One is we have seen a lot of progress recently in with courts, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission interpreting sex protections to also include discrimination based on sexual orientation. There is no question, though, that as we firm up protections based on sex, as we continue to expand their impact to communities once excluded, that will enhance protections for everyone. LGB folks, lesbian, gay, bisexual Americans and individuals, they face discrimination not just based on their sexual orientation, but also their gender expression in a lot of instances. And so as we expand, as we interpret sex protections to include not just trans folks, but anyone who deviates from sort of gender norms and gender stereotypes, the more protections LGBT people as a whole will gain, as well as people who aren't LGBT, who do not conform to gender stereotypes in every way.
So I just want to give our listeners a chance, if they feel that this is an area and a set of issues that they don't know enough about and that they would like to learn more, where would you recommend that they go to get themselves up to speed, not just on the significance for bathrooms, but sort of the broader set of issues that we've been talking about today?
I'd certainly encourage listeners to visit AmericanProgress.org.
I'm shocked to hear you say that, Sarah.
There is a wonderful LGBT page that has resources and information on all of the issues that we've talked about. There are also great resources at transequality.org, which is the website for the National Center for Transgender Equality, which has been a leading institution on this fight. And I also encourage individuals to speak out themselves, progressive individuals, allies who may not know a ton about transgender issues. And I certainly encourage you to educate yourself. But it's never too early to speak up. It's never too early to stand up for a community that for so long has faced attacks from those who are opposed to our equality, and in response so often seen silence from our allies. So I encourage everyone to speak up.
Sarah McBride from the Center for American Progress and Selfie Fame, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis, and we have a special episode this week. The White House is commemorating National Reentry Week all week. And so to kick things off right, we have with us a very special guest. His name is Daryl Atkinson, and he is the inaugural Second Chance Fellow at the Department of Justice. Daryl, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you for having me, Rebecca.
So tell me, what is this fellowship about, and how did you come to DOJ to do this work?
I think the department came to the recognition that it wasn't hearing from all stakeholders. So in any administration, you have limited time, bandwidth, political capital to get anything done. And, you know, juxtaposed to that, you have a laundry list of policy priorities that you might want to achieve. as a result, you have to triage and cull that list down. And, you know, prior to institutionalizing this fellowship, they had been doing that without hearing from the people directly impacted by those choices, people who had been through the criminal justice system. So one of my primary roles is to serve as a conduit to directly impacted communities so they can hear from all stakeholders, so people who've been impacted by the system, people who've successfully reentered into society, can add their knowledge and skills to help the department make good choices on effective reentry policy and practices.
And you yourself were impacted by the system.
Correct, correct. In 1996, I was convicted of a first-time nonviolent drug crime. I was sentenced to 10 years in prison. I served a 40-month mandatory minimum on that sentence. This was in 1996 at the height of the war on drugs. The state of Alabama was nearly as progressive as many other states in offering post-secondary education opportunities. So I went into prison with a high school diploma. I came out with a high school diploma. Fortunate enough for me, I had a loving family to return to who provided my most basic needs, food, clothing, and shelter. As a result, I didn't have those really pressing life pressures pressing down upon me, and I could make rational choices. I could think. I could make a plan. And since November 1999, I've gotten my education, my associate's degree, bachelor's degree, law degree. I'm licensed to practice law in Minnesota and North Carolina. And prior to coming to DOJ, I was a senior staff attorney at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. And my primary practice area was removing the barriers triggered by contact with the criminal justice system using public policy reform and direct legal services.
We've talked a lot on this show in the past about the types of barriers that people can face, whether it's to employment or housing or education. So tell us a little bit about what you're going to be doing with this fellowship to serve as that conduit so that impacted people like yourself have a voice that's being heard by the administration.
Sure. So it's really broken up into three primary roles. One, serving as an advisor to the Bureau of Justice Assistance on their Second Chance portfolio. The Office of Justice Programs is funds community-based organizations to offer reentry programming and practices. So I can help shape some of what that strategy should look like. The second role is being an advisor to the Federal Interagency Reentry Council, and I can't remember the exact year. I think it was 2011. Former Attorney General Eric Holder created the Reentry Council. It's been headed by Amy Solomon, and they've been doing great work. It's a coalition of over 20 federal agencies that are looking at policies both internally and external facing that remove barriers and create opportunity for people with records. So I advise that group. And then the third is serving as that bridge between impacted communities and the administration. And that input from impacted communities is really going to happen in two primary ways. And I want to talk about number one. I'm going to do a series of qualitative interviews with highly successful people who have had an incarceration experience, gotten out, and are now making amazing contributions to their communities. I tend to think there's something that we can learn from those folks. You know, they haven't just read about it. They aren't just practitioners. They've done it as well.
They're the real experts.
Yeah, they're the real experts. So we should be mining their knowledge to see what were the key interventions that happened in their lives that made them able to be successful. And let's try to take those to scale. And the interviews also serve a secondary purpose. They'll be digitally recorded using an online platform. And, you know, I'm going to create a story bank where people in the public can go access these stories. Because, unfortunately, Rebecca, we aren't just going to policy our way out of this problem. We have to shift the narrative and the culture of how, you know, people, policymakers think about people who've come in contact with the system. And so people will have access to the story bank to be able to go and listen to a Glenn Martin or Vivian Nixon or Dorsey Nunn talk about the key interventions that help create pathways to success for them. And I hope it will create more proximity where people don't think of people who've come in contact with the system as so different from them. They could see, you know, maybe a brother or a cousin or a neighbor in that story. And it should diminish some of the otherness that we think about when we think of people living in poverty, when we think of people who might have been impacted by the criminal justice system. And the hope is to bridge that divide, which should open more room to get good things done.
Are you optimistic that we're going to be able to see that kind of culture shift now that we've reached a point where one in three Americans has some type of criminal record?
You know, that's the flips or a good unintended consequence of our system, you know, I guess, you know, touching so many lives. So one in three Americans, you're exactly right, have some sort of criminal record. I think it's 85 million, according to the latest Bureau of Justice statistics. And as a result, you know, the people who you sit next to in church, the folks who, you know, you both drop your kids off at daycare, some of those people have criminal record history. And so I hope that as these stories are unveiled, folks can start seeing more direct relationship with people who've had that type of contact. And, you know, I think we're starting to see some openings on some other fronts where we can draw some analogies where that's already happening. When you think about prescription drug abuse and the way that we talk about that particular problem now is much different than the way we talked about the crack epidemic, for example. I think some of that is due to lessons learned, but I think some of that is also due to the demographics changing and the face of it looking very different, and people can see, you know, people like themselves who are impacted by that problem now. The criminal justice system and people with records, as you said, one in three Americans is, you know, grown to a level where I think people will also see that a similar commonality.
You were talking about the prescription drug epidemic very diplomatically. I commend you, right? The demographics changing. I mean, I would go so far as to say that when we're talking about drugs that are used, such as, you know, the crack epidemic, right, that spurred the war on drugs, that are used by primarily Black and Brown communities and low-income communities, that's a criminal justice problem, but that when it's prescription drugs being used by white residents of suburbs in New England, that, oh, all of a sudden it's a medical problem. Is that a fair way to characterize it?
I think.
Or am I too cynical these days?
I think, you know, without imputing any malevolent intent, I think part of it really is us learning lessons that, you know, the criminal justice system is ineffective as the social service of first response in all situations. So I think we've learned that lesson. I also do acknowledge the fact that, you know, when there is proximity to a problem, when people can see it impacting people such as themselves, people like them, people who are there in relationship with, they are more empathetic and more willing to think of alternative approaches. And, you know, we need to be able to point that out so that that contradiction, you know, doesn't continue to play itself out.
So backing up, I mentioned at the top that, I mean, one of the reasons we're having you on the show finally today is that the White House is holding something they're calling National Reentry Week. What is Reentry Week all about, and why are they doing this?
Yeah, so the first time in history, Attorney General Loretta Lynch designated National Reentry Week to occur April 24th through the 30th. And, you know, obviously the Obama administration is all on board as well. And it's really about raising the profile of these issues to engage in collective action across the country. So when she designated the week, she sent a letter to the 94 U.S. attorneys, the over 120 BOP wardens, and, you know, requested that they hold reentry events, as well as members of the Federal Interagency Reentry Council. And the response has been tremendous. We We have over 200 events scheduled across the country, ranging from job fairs for formerly incarcerated people to children's events for children of incarcerated parents. And, you know, to build a collective narrative that we have to have a sustained, prolonged commitment to kind of see our way out of this problem. You know, one policy didn't create it. One administration can't solve it. And I think having events such as National Reentry Week kind of institutionalizes a level of visibility that we can hopefully continue to shine a light on these issues.
And we are really glad that the administration is holding this. This is obviously an issue that is near and dear to all of our hearts here at Talk Poverty Radio, as well as at the Center for American Progress. And I will show my cards a little bit. We've got a great episode planned today. We're kicking things off about as strong as we can with you. But we also have on several individuals to talk about their own stories, about the people that they work with, and also about the ways that they're trying to make policy change. And one of the campaigns underway that I am most excited about and most proud of is one that we at CAP are involved with, and you know about it because we've talked about it, but it's called the Clean Slate Campaign. Mm-hmm. We're going to hear from the lead sponsor in the state Senate in Pennsylvania, who actually just introduced legislation, first in the nation legislation, to enable people with minor criminal records to earn a clean slate when they've remained crime-free for a certain period of time. He's a Republican, so it's actually a Republican-led idea. So I'm curious to hear from you a little bit about where we need to go from here. Holding a week is a great thing. Designating a full week and having the White House behind it and having all these events, I mean, it all sounds great, right? Definitely a step in the right direction in terms of awareness. But you mentioned culture change and you mentioned your optimism. What is it that we need to do as people who care about these issues to achieve that kind of culture change? Does language have anything to do with it? You mentioned that we can't just policy our way out of the problem. What is it that we need to be doing?
I would say a deep, sustained, long-term commitment. So when I look at my own reentry trajectory and what allowed me to pursue success, it was my family meeting those most basic human needs, those Maslownian needs. You remember Abraham Maslow in the hierarchy of needs, right?
He's got that pyramid, yeah, right? So you've got like all these different things that you can't get to the next level of the pyramid if you haven't met the base of it.
Absolutely. So they not only provided those things, but they also helped fund my college education because at that time, the collateral consequence of a drug crime was that you didn't qualify for federal student loan aid. And so I was barred from getting that type of aid. And they also, you know, really didn't use my past as an anchor on any of my future dreams or possibilities. Now let's take that to scale for the 85 million people who have criminal records, and we can do that with effective reentry program and a policy initiative, but also really thinking differently about those people. You know, my family was deeply invested in my success, and I think we as a country should approach people who have had contact with the system the same way, not as some kind of foreign other, but really people who are part of the American family because they're someone's son, they're someone's mother, they're someone's relative, and they're coming back to our communities, and we should want them to be fully functioning, participating people in our society. And that requires both, you know, programming to meet those most basic needs, policy that creates opportunity for people to pursue their dreams, and a level of proximity to people, to just see them as people. And your point around language is critically important. I know the Urban Institute issued a blog where they talked about that they aren't going to use language that seeks to define people solely by their contact with the criminal justice system anymore.
Like ex-offender.
Like ex-offender, ex-felon, ex-convict, because one, it isn't accurate. It doesn't completely describe a person. It describes conduct that we have deemed illegal and that people have paid their debt to society for. But two, these terms are highly stigmatized and they conjure the most you know, horrific and terrible images, and that people are solely defined by some of their worst choices. So, you know, at the department, we're in robust discussions around this as well, around how should we refer to people who've been involved in the criminal justice system. And I just try to keep it really simple. How about people? People who've been to jail, people who've been to prison, people with criminal records. But the operative word is people, to really affirm their humanity and not solely define folks by some of their worst decisions.
Daryl Atkinson is the first ever Second Chance Fellow at the Department of Justice. Thank you so much, Daryl, for being with us today for Reentry Week. And stay tuned. We are next going to be speaking with a young man who was an intern at the White House who himself has a criminal record. And that's the show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. You can find us anytime at www.talkpoverty.org/podcast, where we have a full archive of all past shows. You can also listen to us anytime as a podcast on iTunes, and send us your pitches to info@talkpoverty.org. Thanks for listening.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clocks by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford, cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working, trying to bring in the dough.